And this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Nigeria elects a new president. Iran nuclear talks extended for one more day. UN removes international staff from Yemen. Children in eastern Ukraine, casualties of war. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Muhammadu Buhari was elected president of Nigeria, beating incumbent Goodluck Jonathan, who conceded defeat. He called Mr. Buhari to congratulate him on winning the election. The Electoral Commission has not declared a winner, but official election results show Mr. Buhari with an insurmountable lead. VOA's Peter Claudy says there may be a court challenge to the election.
He conceded defeat. However, the party could still challenge the result in court, and that is what they intend to do because the Constitution allows them to do that. If they are displeased with some results, constitutionally they can go to court and challenge it.
With almost all those state vote tallies in, Mr. Buhari won a majority of Nigeria's 36 states and leads Mr. Jonathan by more than 2 million votes nationwide. Mr. Buhari's victory ends a 16-year rule of the People's Democratic Party in Nigeria and marks the first time the presidency has changed hands in the country through the ballot box. Mr. Buhari is 72 years old. He was previously Nigeria's military ruler for 20 months after officers seized power in a December 1983 coup. Negotiators discussing the future of Iran's nuclear program have agreed to ignore their midnight Tuesday deadline and continue talks into Wednesday. Negotiators have been aiming to complete a preliminary deal on Iran's nuclear program by midnight Tuesday during talks in Lausanne, Switzerland. Senior Iran negotiator Hamid Bahidinejad spoke with reporters.
There are unresolved issues at this moment which have not been resolved. We are concentrating on finding the best solutions which are mutually agreed by everybody.
Differences remain on such issues as restrictions on uranium enrichment research, how long the deal will last, how quickly sanctions against Iran will be lifted, and what to do if Iran violates the terms. Fighting continued in the center of the strategic Iraqi city of Tikrit Tuesday, even as Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi declared victory in the weeks-long battle to retake the city from the Islamic State group. Mr. Abadi announced the liberation of Tikrit on his Twitter page. The United Nations says the last of its international staffers have left Yemen. UN spokesman Farhan Haq said Tuesday the 13 remaining international staffers have been withdrawn and will return when circumstances permit. He said the UN envoy to Yemen was relocated to Jordan. The United Nations says that 93 civilians have been killed and 364 wounded over the past 5 days during airstrikes by a Saudi-led coalition against Yemen's Houthi Shiite rebels. Airstrikes continued for a six-day Tuesday, destroying missiles and weapon sites around the capital, Sana'a. President Barack Obama told Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi that he will lift the hold on military aid to Cairo that was put in place after the coup in the country. The aid includes F-16 fighter jets, Harpoon missiles, and M1A1 tank kits. The White House says the move is in the interest of U.S. national security. But the White House says it is not certifying that Egypt has made progress toward democracy. A day-long hostage drama in Turkey ended Tuesday with the two kidnappers dead and their hostage seriously wounded. Two members of a banned leftist group seized a Turkish prosecutor in his Istanbul courthouse office. They demanded police and others they hold responsible for the death of a 15-year-old protester confess and be put on trial. Police stormed the prosecutor's office after hearing gunshots. The kidnappers belong to the Revolutionary People's Liberation Party Front, which Turkey, the European Union, and the United States regard as a terrorist group. The United Nations Children's Fund reports more than 150 children have been killed or maimed by landmines and unexploded ordnance during the past year in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions of eastern Ukraine. Lisa Schlein has details.
The United Nations reports the number of people killed in eastern Ukraine since fighting broke out last April now top 6,000. This figure includes at least 109 children who reportedly were injured and 42 killed by landmines and unexploded ordnance. The UN Children's Fund notes, however, these only represent government-reported figures and do not include reports by Russian-backed rebels of injuries and deaths. Therefore, UNICEF spokesman Christoph Bouillerac says they may not reflect the actual number of child casualties.
After a year of conflict, many communities in eastern Ukraine have been exposed to extreme levels of violence, including through the use of heavy weapons. The remnants of these weapons have been left behind in devastated towns and villages.
After fighting has ended, killings go on in battle zones where landmines and unexploded ordnance are left behind. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
German airline Lufthansa says the co-pilot who deliberately crashed a jetliner last week into the French Alps, killing all 150 people aboard, told his flight school in 2009 that he had had a serious depressive episode. Lufthansa says a note was found in emails that the co-pilot, 27-year-old Andreas Lubitz, sent to the airline's flight school when he resumed instruction after an interruption. According to the airline, Lubitz later received a medical certificate confirming his fitness to fly. French President François Hollande said all victims on the flight from Barcelona, Spain, to the German city of Dusseldorf will be identified by DNA samples by the end of this week. Defense lawyers for accused Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev have rested their case after trying to shift jurors' focus onto his older brother Tamerlan, who they say masterminded the April 15, 2013 attack. The defense argues it was Tamerlan who self-radicalized and Dzhokhar merely followed him. Tsarnaev, who is 21, faces the death penalty or life in prison if found guilty of the attack that killed three people and wounded 264 others. The defense has made clear from the beginning of the trial that its strategy is not to win an acquittal for the younger Tsarnaev, but to save him from the death penalty. The White House released President Obama's proposal to cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by up to 28% below 2005 levels within the next decade as part of a global treaty to tackle climate change. The proposal includes several policies already in effect, such as the higher fuel economy standards for trucks and cars, along with energy efficiency measures for buildings and appliances. The plan follows Mr. Obama's pledge last November in Beijing to reduce U.S. climate warming emissions by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels. That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Business News on The Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. U.S. stocks ended near their session lows Tuesday in a retreat from the previous session's sharp rally. But the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ Composite posted their ninth consecutive quarter of gains. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 200 points, a little more than 1%, to close at 17,776. The S&P 500 losing 18 points. It sits at 20,067. The NASDAQ Composite also down by about 46 points to close at 4,900. For the quarter, the Dow and S&P were relatively flat, while growth was in the NASDAQ. It was up 3.5%. An improving job market drove U.S. consumer confidence higher this month after a dip in February, a promising sign for the economy as it heads into the spring. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index rose to 101.3 in March from a revised 98.8 reading in February. Confidence has risen to the highest level since before the Great Recession started in December 2007. A year ago, that index standing at 83.9. U.S. home prices rose at a steady pace in January, pushing prices up at a faster pace than wages, and it put more homes financially out of reach for would-be buyers. The Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller 20-City Home Price Index rose 4.6% in January, compared with 12 months earlier. That's up from a growth of 4.4% in December.
Few Americans have listed their homes for sale. The tight supply has kept prices high. And talks between Greece and its creditors wrapped up for now without a deal to unlock remaining Greek bailout funds urgently needed to stave off a potential default. That's business news on VOA. Checking out the human heart when doctors suspect a problem can often be a tricky procedure when small tubes or catheters are used to look at the condition of blood vessels. On Today's Now, David Byrd tells of a potential breakthrough by adding lasers to the catheters. First, we head to the American Cafe where we find Ira Melman and the story of prisoners helping to preserve some of the more delicate things in our world.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. The United States has the largest prison population in the world, with more than 2 million people behind bars. In a growing number of prisons, inmates are doing more than just serving time. They're rearing endangered plants, animals, and butterflies for release in the wild. Tom Bonsi is here in the cafe with a story of how the concept is spreading across the country and even attracting interest from overseas.
Past two metal detectors and multiple guarded double gates topped with razor wire sits Washington State's Stafford Creek Prison Greenhouse Complex. There, a small crew wearing standard prison-issued khakis is sowing perennials. Months from now, these flowers will be transplanted to remnant prairies around Washington's Puget Sound to provide food for endangered butterflies.
These plants are so fickle.
Toby Earhart and his fellow inmates have plenty of time to nurture, experiment, and hone their craft on tray after tray of seedlings.
You cannot have a nursery that produces these for money because they would go broke or the cost would be so high that nobody could ever restore anything with them. So that's why this is such a good fit to have prisoners doing this because, they don't have to pay as much. So.
The convicted child rapist says his greenhouse work has made him more observant and conscientious. That's the sort of outcome prison superintendent Pat Glebe likes to see.
It helps with the level of violence in prison because these inmates, all of a sudden, they have something else to do, and they see the value in it, and they see the value of giving back.
Glebe says many people have a preconceived notion of what prison looks like. Then they tour his facility and can't help saying, wow. Stafford Creek's Prison Conservation Nursery has produced more than 1 million rare and endangered prairie plants since it opened 5 years ago. Inmates elsewhere are turning over a new leaf, too. At a state prison in Ohio, inmates are rearing endangered eastern hellbender salamanders for release in the wild. In Maryland, inmates do some of the heavy lifting to prepare bags of oyster shells used in restoration of the Chesapeake Bay. In Oregon, a voter-approved ballot measure has long required all inmates to work full-time or attend classes that tests prison managers to find meaningful work activity for everyone, and further explains why Oregon's prison system was fertile ground to host conservation nurseries. A combination of federal, state, and private foundation grants cover most program costs. Tom Kay directs the Institute for Applied Ecology. That's one of the partners bringing money to the table in the Oregon Sustainability in Prisons project. He says, as you might expect, working in prisons presents some challenges.
Just going to visit and volunteer at a prison is no simple task. You have to watch your dress code. You have to watch how you behave in prisons.
But Kay says sticking with it is paying off handsomely on all sides.
Oh, the advantages far outweigh any of these disadvantages. Because we're able to get so much more done for ourselves in the mission that we are trying to accomplish.
And we have to settle it out to get the air out of it.
Participating inmates are paid a nominal rate for their labor, less than a dollar an hour in the Pacific Northwest. The gardening tasks sometimes appear tedious and repetitive.
A couple good scoops.
But that didn't stop inmate Joseph Jonge from applying for a transfer to the 2,000-bed Stafford Creek Prison specifically so he could compete for a job in the conservation nursery.
It's hard to get into the program, but when you get into the program, what they teach you is something that you probably won't get somewhere else, because most of the seeds they're having us grow are endangered plants that you won't find anywhere else in the U.S. except here.
Washington's original environmental science program has branched out in many directions. At this prison, inmates also train shelter dogs to make them more adoptable. Other inmates are trying their hand at fish farming, yet other inmates refurbish bicycles and wheelchairs for the needy on the outside. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi near Aberdeen, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Have a seat and enjoy every day, anytime you want at voanews.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. The United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention says that in 2013, 1 million Americans had cardiac catheterization. That's where doctors insert a small tube into a blood vessel in your leg, wind it up into your heart, and look and see if you're okay. With those catheters, doctors can see if vital coronary arteries around your heart are blocked, if a stent needs to be put in to open them up, if the blood vessel needs widening, or if previous surgery needs repairing. There's only one problem. The machine that is commonly used sometimes doesn't give doctors an accurate picture of what's happening inside the major blood vessels or the heart. That's where a team of researchers and doctors at Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, comes in. They have developed a new catheter that uses a laser beam firing 2.8 million pulses per second and rotating mirrors to produce a superfine image. Think of it as super HD for your blood vessels. And the laser, the motor, the rotating mirror, and all the wires are contained inside a catheter that is about the size of a thick fishing line. Professor Ton van der Steen is the head of biomedical engineering at the Thorax Center at Erasmus.
In the traditional way of imaging, you have a motor outside of the body, and at the end of a catheter, you have a tip that needs to rotate. So the rotation needs to be transferred all the way through the catheter, which is very complex. With this system, you have the rotation exactly where it needs to be, only in the tip. So you have a micromotor in the tip that can rotate, and that's why it can rotate so fast and so accurately.
The new catheter, called the Heartbeat Optical Coherence Tomography Catheter, can complete the imaging with 2,500 images in the time it takes for just two heartbeats. The system takes such good pictures of the arteries around the heart that cardiologist Evelyn Rieger says it looks like something out of a textbook.
And that really means that suddenly we get a view on the blood vessel like we just know from the textbook. And we can see that in our living patients at the very moment when we have to do the operation.
These images are several times sharper than current images, which can be distorted by the movement of a heartbeat and make only 100 images in 1 second. The problem is that can lead to a poor evaluation of a person's heart and poor or incorrect treatment. Dr. Robert Wilensky is an interventional cardiologist at the hospital at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. He says the new catheter is a major step forward.
And so I think this is going to be a major advance. It's going to allow us to look closer into the arterial wall, determine with greater certainty whether a stent has been adequately placed or will be placed in the right location.
Dr. Evelyn Rieger says that this new catheter will help cut down on the number of patients who have to come back for a procedure.
So there are two reasons why patients have to come back when we treat them for an acute heart attack. One reason, and this is roughly half of the patients, have to come back because we did not an excellent job in the blockage that is causing the heart attack. And the other half of the patient has to come back because we overlook additional lesions, additional problems that are present in the artery.
Tianxi Wang is a biomedical engineering student who defended his PhD thesis on the heartbeat OCT, and he was one of the key inventors of the system. He says that the new catheter is just a first step.
So the current limitation of this micromotor is a key component, which is magnetic. This component limits the size of the motor to 1 millimeter. So if we want to make this motor smaller, we should make this component smaller. I think in the upcoming few months, we will make this motor 0.5 millimeter or even smaller.
So what do you think? Let us know your opinion on this story by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And remember, you can email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
Police in Idaho say a man called the emergency phone number 911 a dozen times to report he was overcharged at a bar. Philip Posnier was given a ride home by police after he was kicked out of Club Tequila just after 1 a.m. early Monday. Posnier then began repeatedly calling 911. A bartender reportedly says he was charged $30 for 10 beers. His tab has now grown to a potential $1,000 fine. It's time for sports on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. The Kentucky Wildcats are just two wins away from finishing a perfect season in men's college basketball. That would be the first since 1976. And they have some potentially unlikely fans behind them. Quinn Buckner says he and his 1976 Indiana teammates aren't chilling any champagne to uncork a celebration in case of a Kentucky loss. Instead, the nation's last undefeated college basketball team says it is eager to end the 39-year wait and add another member to the club, even if it happens to be an old rival trying to make history in the Hoosiers' backyard. The Final Four, of course, taking place in Indianapolis, Indiana. Buckner, an Olympic gold medalist and NBA champion with the Boston Celtics, is now a TV analyst for the Pacers. He says, "I think for me and my teammates, it's hard to pull against young people. Perhaps these Hoosiers feel safe knowing that. Just 2 years ago, the NCAA named them the greatest team in college basketball history. Or perhaps it's because their reign has survived so many other threats. Last March, Wichita State came into the tournament 35-0. And guess who they lost to? Yep, Kentucky, on the first weekend of the NCAA tournament." Well, just 2 days after leaving Texas, Rick Barnes has landed a job at Tennessee, which announced the hiring Tuesday, calling Barnes an elite basketball coach in every respect. The agreement is for 6 years, $2.25 million annually. The school scheduled an afternoon news conference. Barnes succeeds Donnie Tindall, who was fired Friday after one season amid an NCAA investigation of his 2 years at Southern Mississippi. Rick Barnes, of course, the former coach of Texas. I like to say he's the former coach of Clemson, but that's another story. Oklahoma Thunder star Kevin Durant has had successful bone graft surgery for a fracture in his right foot. The team has said the National Basketball Association's reigning MVP will miss the rest of the season and is expected to return to full basketball activities in 4 to 6 months. It was the third surgery Durant has had on the foot. He had the initial procedure last October. That's a look at sports from the Voice of America. Musicians are facing real financial problems in the digital streaming age. On Monday, Jay-Z, the rap star and entertainment mogul, announced plans to confront the issue with plans for Tidal. It's a subscription streaming service he recently bought for $56 million. Facing competition from Spotify, Google, and other companies that will soon include Apple, Tidal will be fashioned as a home for high-fidelity audio and exclusive content. In New York, Jay-Z stood alongside more than a dozen musicians identified as Tidal's owners, including Beyoncé, who happens to be Jay-Z's wife. Jay-Z did not speak, but Ms. Keys said the musician's wish is to forever change the course of music history. Jay-Z doesn't sing right here, but Beyoncé does, with music sure to be a part of Tidal. Here's 7-Eleven. Show the sky way, smack it in the air. Let's move it, stop the sky, smack it in the air. Let's move it, stop the sky, smack it in the air. Show the sky way, smack it in the air. Smack it in the air. My foot up, hold up, now my foot up, I'm spinning, my foot up.
Beyoncé and 7-Eleven, some would say Beyoncé, the better half of the duo with Jay-Z. Perhaps the most notable part of Jay-Z's new strategy is that a majority of this company will be owned by the artists themselves. Tidal, which makes millions of songs and thousands of high-definition videos available in 31 countries, will have no free version. Instead, it will have two subscription tiers defined by audio quality, $10 a month for compressed format and $20 for CD-quality streams. The new company is called Tidal. Look for it. That's music on VOA Global. A large rooster is missing. Police in Athens, Georgia, are searching for whoever made off with Rocket the Rusty Rooster, a 10-foot-tall, 300-pound metal sculpture stolen from its perch outside of a Athens business. Police say the estimated value of the artwork is about $3,000, meaning that whoever stole it could be facing a felony. The rooster's installation 2 weeks ago involved anchoring the big bird into the ground with rebar stakes, some sort of tool they think was used to cut the bird from its perch as part of 1 foot remains in the ground. Well, meanwhile, another bird we mentioned yesterday about the numerous symbols adopted by various U.S. states and one proposal in particular in New Hampshire. As it turns out, this bird's best friend may actually be a cat. The highly publicized and unsuccessful bill proposed by a group of fourth graders to designate the red-tailed hawk as New Hampshire's official raptor is now back. It will be added to a Senate bill seeking to name the bobcat as the state's official wildcat. The hawk bill failed after a recent debate after some of the lawmakers said the students' effort was frivolous and cut into time that should be spent on more pressing issues. Senator Jeff Woodburn says he'll be attaching the hawk language to the bobcat bill to right a serious wrong. So we'll have to see how that all shakes out in the New Hampshire Senate. We're about ready to shake out of Studio 23. Our time is coming to an end. Our director is Tracy Carter. Our engineers today, Kelvin Fowler and Jimmy Cook. And our managing editor is Diane Gal. Why don't you stop back by again tomorrow at this time? We'll get together for another version of VOA Global.